we know that strong and accountable institutions that effectively implement macrofiscal, monetary, central banking, financial policy can indeed play an essential role in preventing state fragility from turning into failure.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, the growing costs associated with fragility and conflict and what this institution is trying to do about it.
The strategy is not about changing the mandate of the fund at all. It instead aims at enhancing the fund effectiveness and impact in those countries impacted by fragility and conflict in accordance with its mandate and core competencies. My name is Frank Bousquet. I am Deputy Director, coordinating the work of the IMF in fragile and conflict-affected states.
So why this special focus now on fragile and conflict-affected states?
Well, listen, state fragility and conflict are clearly among the most enduring challenge of our times. I mean, if you look at fragile and conflict-affected states, which we call FCS, they are home today about 1 billion people, nearly doubling the number we had 20 years ago.
Wow.
And just a few statistics, you know, in terms of the state of fragility, as we say today. Even before COVID-19 pandemic, the level of violence were at their 30-year peak, with almost 80 million people around the world who had become forcefully displaced. Hmm. Another number, the world population living within 60 kilometers of a major conflict event has doubled to 220 million since 2007. And if you are not yet convinced about the issue at stake, you should just know that about 155 million people across the globe are estimated to be acutely food insecure, with about 66% of them in just 10 countries that are actually impacted by fragility and conflict. Mm-hmm. So all in all, if you look at the trends, if that continues, fragile and conflict-affected states may host 60% of the global poor by 2030, although they in fact comprise just over 10% of the world population.
Mm. And so why is this happening?
Well, because, you know, look at the trends. Fragility and conflict affect, but are also affected by global trends such as climate change, demographics, gender inequalities, illicit trafficking. And more recently, given the ongoing COVID crisis, those countries are facing the perfect storm. So in addition to social tension, security crisis, extreme poverty, as I mentioned, government today need also to tackle the health and economic aftershocks of the pandemic. And overall, our numbers shows that the COVID-19 pandemic has really exacerbated income divergence between those countries impacted by fragility and conflict and the rest of the world. If you just look at in terms of projections, our current projections suggest that the per capita income in FCS will not recover to their 2019 level before 2024. Debt and inflation pressure in FCS have also significantly risen during the pandemic. So all in all, those countries impacted by fragility and conflict are today at a significant risk of falling behind in their post-pandemic recovery, but also in terms of achieving sustainable development goals.
Wow. I mean, that is not a pretty picture that you're painting. Why should the fund, why should the IMF get involved in this? I mean, what might humanitarians and macroeconomists have in common?
Well, first, I would say that about a fifth of IMF members are classified as fragile and conflict-affected states. This is significant. And we should also emphasize the spillover that comes from fragility and conflict, which are also strengthening and threatening the stability in neighboring countries and regions. Now, in line with its mandate, what is the fund doing? The fund is a global institution with a responsibility to address threats to members' economic stability. And that includes threats coming from fragility and conflict. It's very important to really capture the link between peace and stability on one hand and macroeconomic stability. On the one hand, fragility and conflict obviously are going to undermine macroeconomic stability, the development of productive resource, creating also exacerbating balance of payment needs. But also on the other hand, macroeconomic stability and inclusive economic growth are indeed essential to reducing fragility and promoting resilience. So the role of the fund is clear. Fragility and conflict are macro-critical and directly relevant to the fund mandate. And the last point, if I may, since you are raising the questions about humanitarian and macroeconomists, what do they have in common? I would say that it's important to realize that those countries impacted by fragility and conflict, FCS, they face complex but also quite unique challenge in terms of provision of security, rule of law, low state capacity, governance, low level of trust, and potential for spillover. What does that mean? It means that no single organization can succeed alone. All those challenges require support and cooperation between actors that have different mandates. And that's where you see the importance of partnership between humanitarian, who have a key role to play during conflict and active crisis, but also financial development actors, which are coming with their own core competency, but very complementary.
But what can they do? I mean, what are the tangible things that the IMF can do to support these populations? I mean, what can they do that other development agencies aren't doing?
So, first, you know, the IMF has a long-standing engagement in countries impacted by fragility and conflict. And it has, over the past decade, helped many of those countries achieving macroeconomic stabilization, which lays the foundation for sustained growth and build progressively stronger institutions. And as you can see, this is really complementary to what peace, security, or humanitarian actors are doing. So if I would like to just summarize, I think looking at the past decades, the fund has really some key comparative advantage in fragile and conflict-affected states, which is based on the following four pillars. The first one is really laying the foundation for inclusive growth and macroeconomic stability. The key point here is to say that sustainable economic growth that provides fair opportunities to all members of a society is in fact a key ingredient to prevent the emergence of fragility and conflict risk. Sustainable development opportunities are crucial in this regard. And this, of course, requires stable macroeconomic environment. So clearly, on this first pillar, the fund has helped and can help countries impacted by fragility and conflict to accomplish this goal through tailored policy advice and helping also addressing the balance of payment and fiscal imbalance. I think the second comparative advantage of the fund is building institutions. The fund helps build capacity of institutions to implement sound policies for macroeconomic stabilization and promoting inclusive economic growth. Capacity development is, in fact, core to the fund expertise, and it's essential, again, to prevent entry and helping exit from fragility. And it's about some key core competency area of the fund. It's about helping country in terms of tax and revenue administration, in terms of public financial management, in terms of monetary policy, central banking, in terms of financial supervision. So third area, which is very important for the fund, is to provide financial assistance when needed. So while you see multilateral development banks, all the MDBs, who play a key role in terms of financing long-term country-driven solution for sustainable growth, the fund is coming with its own financial assistance to really help countries to meet the balance of payment needs and to provide fiscal financing. This is essential. And the last area that I would say in terms of comparative advantage of the fund in FCS is really to catalyze donor support. And we don't talk enough about this area, which is essential. Fund engagement in FCS can be instrumental in catalyzing donor assistance. This is what we see has happened over the past decades. When you look actually in the response of the fund to the COVID-19 crisis, multilateral and bilateral debt relief have played an important role in ensuring liquidity provision for FCS, and that has been well noted in many evaluations. So all in all, the fund has really a unique comparative advantage in FCS, very much in complementarity to what peace, security, humanitarian, or development actors are doing.
And what kind of, I mean, you mentioned a few of them there already, but the financial tools that the fund has at its disposal now to help these countries, maybe you could give us a couple of examples of those and you know, one of the problems that people speak about is the tracking of the use of these funds, especially these days during the pandemic, when a lot of money is being thrown at governments. How do you track the use of these funds when government institutions are weak, which is the case for most fragile states?
So let me come to these questions about what are the different tools at the disposal of the fund, especially in those countries where capacity is very often an issue. Mm-hmm. I would say before talking about financing, it's about the surveillance, which is carried out by the IMF. Very important for those countries, and I will tell you why. Mm-hmm. Article 4 consultation at a country level allow the fund to provide all the analysis, the policy advice to help those countries addressing risk to stability and achieving growth. And in fact, those Article 4 reports provide really the macroeconomic assessment to all the other international partners, but also to monitor the risk to the economy. Once again, we don't talk enough, but surveillance has a key role to be played in those countries, especially in terms of leveraging other partners and catalyzing other support from other entities. The second area, which I think is very important, which goes beyond financing, is again capacity development. I said a few words before. I will just emphasize the fact this is really often the area where the fund can make a critical contribution in FCS to help build institutions that can implement sound macroeconomic policies, which is again critical for peace and stability. In terms of numbers, capacity development is actually quite important in fragile and conflictive states. This accounts for about 1/4 of the total fund capacity development spending over the last 4 years.
Wow.
And once again, those areas are typically in line with the core competency of the fund. Budget execution, banking regulation, strengthening central banks. That's exactly what the fund is doing. And it's so critical in those countries that don't have the system in place, including to track funding, as you were rightly mentioning. The third area is indeed the financing, Bruce. Yeah. And here, just a few numbers. If you look between January 2010 and March 2020, over the past 10 years, mm-hmm. the fund has actually supported almost 30 fragile and conflict-affected states with 90 programs and financing totaling $20 billion. Mm-hmm. Now, looking at the COVID-19 pandemic response that you mentioned, the fund has actually played a critical role in terms of emergency financing, but also in terms of debt sustainability initiative. I mentioned 30 members have received emergency financial support worth about $8 billion. The IMF and the World Bank have actually jointly supported the implementation of the G20 Debt Service Suspension Initiative, yeah. where 24 eligible FCS have requested to participate since September 2021. And the fund, you know, has provided a number of funding over the past decades, emergency financing, also supported by the Extended Credit Facility, as we call ECF. Mm-hmm. Last points, we should mention the recent SDR allocation. FCS have benefited from it. They have benefited for about $16 billion from the recent SDR allocation. Is it useful? Yes, because it directly boosts foreign exchange reserve, which supports external stability and confidence. And some of those countries are already using and planning to use those new SDR to finance vital imports.
You know, you were looking at fragile states at the World Bank mm-hmm. before coming to the fund. What would you say is different between the bank and the fund in terms of the way those institutions look at fragile states?
Well, I would say that, you know, given their closely connected mandates, both the fund and the bank actually share complementarities in supporting those countries. The fund works basically to foster global monetary cooperation, secure financial stability, and clearly you have the fund main comparative advantage that are clearly spelled out in what I presented earlier today. Mm-hmm. The bank is providing financing, technical assistance to really looking at long-term economic development to end extreme poverty and build shared prosperity. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the recent strategy of the World Bank in supporting fragile and conflict-affected states, the whole point is how to help countries addressing the key drivers and impact of fragility and to strengthen their resilience from a development perspective. The fund is looking at the same key drivers of fragility. And in fact, we aim at systematizing the cooperation with the World Bank in many of those analytics and assessment. But obviously, the way it will be operationalized will be different.
So you are presenting a proposal to the IMF board in March that has actually benefited from consultations within and outside of the fund on how to best support fragile and conflict-affected states. What's in this new strategy? I mean, how do you propose dealing with issues that the fund has traditionally stayed well away from, like peace and security, for example, which is such a huge part of the problem for many of these countries?
Well, the proposed strategy is in fact a response to a board-endorsed recommendation of the 2018 Independent Evaluation Office report, which was assessing the IMF engagement in fragile states. And you know, this Independent Evaluation Office did an excellent work in terms of assessing all the progress made by the fund over the past year in its engagement with fragile states, but also some of the key challenges that remained. And those challenges, what are they? First, the importance to tailor the support, to really take into account the key drivers of fragility. As I mentioned, those countries, they face complex but also unique challenge. And obviously, this will require greater country specificity with due consideration given to those conditions. The second point that was noted by the IEO, the Independent Evaluation Office, was the need for the fund to enhance its response to the growing capacity building needs of those countries, but also better tailor capacity development, again, linking that with the low absorption capacity. The third area was really a point about scaling up, improving partnership with other organizations, that especially those that have actually extensive local footprint where the fund is not necessarily present. And then the last point that was mentioned, which I think is important to share, is also the need for the fund to strengthen support to our staff so that they have the right incentive to work in those countries, but also to ensure that they have the right support and training. So in response to your question, I would say that the proposed strategy aims at addressing those points. The strategy is not about changing the mandate of the fund at all. It instead aims at enhancing the fund effectiveness and impact in those countries in accordance with its mandate and core competencies. So there are a few areas and direction that the proposed strategy will focus on. And we have been actually engaging over the past year in major consultation within, but also with outside, with external partners. And that has been really important. First area is really enhancing the fund understanding of the conditions of those countries impacted by fragility and conflict. The idea is to roll out what we call country engagement strategy for all FCS countries to better identify the drivers of fragility and conflict, to then being able to better inform specific decision on policy advice, financial support, capacity building, with a view really to ensure that appropriate tailoring of the fund engagement to the key drivers of fragility and conflict, whether it's about surveillance, you remember I mentioned surveillance is so important, or capacity development, or program conditionalities. This has to be done by taking into account the key drivers of fragility of each country. And each country is fragile in its own way. So this has to be done at the country level. Another important feature, I think, of the proposed strategy is, again, to recognize how capacity development, if it's well-tailored, has a huge role to play to build in the medium to long-term institutions. And again, it's an area of core competency of the fund. So under the strategy, we'll be proposing to significantly scale up our capacity development in core area of expertise, but also, and that will be my last 2 points, by deploying more and better skilled staff in FCS on the ground. Why? To enhance dialogue with authorities, but also to better adapt IMF support to the local absorptive capacity and to strengthen the partnership with other actors on the ground. And this is maybe the last point I will mention about the strategy that we are proposing, which is really placing a strong emphasis on more collaboration with other external partners, which aims at aligning engagement on the ground and raising synergy. For instance, in capacity development, to avoid duplication or excessive demands on authorities that have typically low capacity. And this is extremely important across all countries, but especially in FCS, because as I mentioned before, you need to partner with organizations that have the presence, that have the intelligence, that have the analytics to better inform you how to design a well-tailored engagement in those situations.
Wow, that's a pretty broad-reaching project with a lot of challenges. Frank Bousquet, Deputy Director and Coordinator of the Fund's work on fragile and conflict-affected states, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bruce.
You can find lots more about how the IMF is supporting fragile and conflict-affected states at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at imf_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.